Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about movement disorders on the show today. Back with us, Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent. She's a neurologist whose focus is the care of patients with movement disorders and in designing unique programs that suit their particular conditions. She's the program director at UW Health's Movement Disorders Clinic. So, do you or someone you care about have a movement disorder? What questions do you have about treatments? What would you like to know about the symptoms? We'll take your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we'd love to hear from you. And Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us again today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be able to do this again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. First, give us a definition of a movement disorder. What is it?
Right. So it's just as the name describes, movement disorder. So people with certain brain conditions will have difficulty moving or using their arms and legs and different parts of their body. And so this, of course, can cause different types of disability. One of the main movement disorders that we see is due to Parkinson's disease. So many of the patients that I see will be affected with Parkinson's disease. But there's other things, other different disorders that can cause shaking, so tremor disorders and different specific forms of muscle spasms that will form this group of disorders called dystonia as well.
So the symptoms of these diseases can be varied?
Quite varied, right. Even within Parkinson's disease, which people often think, oh, that should be a pretty uniform disease, there's quite a degree of variability from individual to individual on the severity of their symptoms, as well as how quickly it progresses. And so although there's things in common with the particular disease entities, there will be individual variability.
Yeah. And do we know the causes behind the movement disorders? I mean, the diseases themselves?
Not really, although there's lots of theories and lots of research directed at this. There does seem to be some type of genetic component for many of them, although gene testing itself does not necessarily reveal that in its current state. So we aren't always recommending gene testing. And there are some other things that can that need to occur if someone is going to undergo gene testing. However, we also feel that in order for certain diseases to become symptomatic, something has to trigger them. And this could be, for example, something in the environment or an exposure to a certain virus or something. And that might vary among individuals.
Yeah. Would age play a role, too?
To some degree, for some of them, especially Parkinson's, it is felt to be age-related to some degree.
You know, we should talk a bit about the movement disorders clinic at UW Health. Tell us about what all goes on there.
Yeah, so it's a group of clinicians that specialize in movement disorders. So, for example, the physicians have done extra training beyond their neurology residency for a year or two in focusing on the different movement disorders. And we have a group of nurses that have a special interest in movement disorders, and so they can field lots of questions for our patients when they call in or message us on the electronic medical record. We have physical therapists and speech pathologists and occupational therapists that also specialize in these disorders to give very specialized, high-level care. We're also fortunate to have a social worker that's very interested and can give, you know, give a unique perspective for our patients that is very helpful, because some of the disorders are relatively rare. For example, Huntington's disease is a disorder that we see as well, and we have a we're a center of excellence in Wisconsin for treatment of Huntington's disease, but it's a relatively rare disorder and has some very, you know, unique features to it, that so that if we, the clinic physicians and staff, if we are all special, have a special interest in this, we can give the patients a hopefully better care because we have a unique perspective to help them with.
Yeah, as you were talking, I'm thinking, man, you must have some problems during this COVID-19 situation in terms of working with people.
Right, right. So, for example, many to diagnose these disorders, we need to have patients come into our clinic, and we need to do a neurologic exam in which we're testing physically various parts of the nervous system. There's different things that we can do. And it's, you know, we can't do that over the phone through telemedicine. If there's a video connection, you know, that might be a little better, but there's certain parts of the exam where we need to, like, feel someone's arm or leg, for example. And, of course, you can't do that unless if they're physically with you. So it's made it difficult for patients who are new to us to become diagnosed. We still try to make contact with them at least to get things rolling as best we can. But yeah, follow-up visits on the telephone can go much better, but still sure. Sometimes can be frustrating. But we're doing the best we can. And I have to say the patients that I've gotten to speak with on the phone, et cetera, you know, they're very understanding of the situation.
Yeah, I would think so. And you wonder, I would expect that some people, or at least with some of these disorders, they would might be more vulnerable to the COVID-19.
There is some thought of that, especially in people who have neurodegenerative disorders, which is what Parkinson's is and Huntington's disease is, depending on the phase or stage of their disease, how severely they're affected by it, they could be at considerable risk if they have COVID. So we've taken that very seriously, which is why we're so strictly restricting people who we actually have come in. Because for many of these disorders, certainly we want to give someone a diagnosis, but there isn't a treatment that we can start that will halt the progression of their symptoms. So yeah. When you're talking about life and death issues, which, you know, occurs with COVID, you know, it totally changes your perspective.
The disorder, is there something that all these disorders have in common, or?
Well, many of them are felt to be due to problems with a certain part of the brain. However, you know, I would say 60 to 70% of the patients I see have Parkinson's disease. And so that's what we spend a lot of time treating. Yeah, but there's a certain part of the brain called the basal ganglia that is felt where most of the damage and problems are occurring for these disorders.
We have callers online with some questions, so let's go to the phones. Laura in Grand Marsh up now. Laura, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have been seeing a doctor at the university, a neurologist, for about 20 years now because I had a brain tumor removed. And one of the things that I've been dealing with is that I have what they call pseudo-seizures. Whenever I overexert myself or whatever, I start shaking and I can't talk. And I he's going to retire now, and I'm just really worried that I'm not going to get, you know, that he's the one that's really been helping me with everything. And so what I want to find out is I'm 73 years old now, and I'm wondering, it seems like I have a lot more shaking than I used to have and stuff. And I was wondering, He's going to do a tele visit with me before he retires this Friday, and I want to know, is there a way then that I can find out if I might be dealing with Parkinson's too because of my age, and also because this seems to be exaggerated now?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Laura, yeah, thank you for calling, Laura. Dr. Bouillon-Dent?
Right. So what can happen, what will happen at your telephone visit is that they will connect you with another neurologist as well. So you'll have your final visit with this neurologist that is retiring, but that doesn't mean your care is going to end there. And so it sounds like you have this wonderful relationship with this neurologist, but our clinic is very good at connecting you with the next person that would continue your care, and that person will then decide if you need to be seen by, you know, somebody else in our clinic as well for further evaluation of different potential diagnoses. The one thing to know is when people have tremors for whatever reason, when they're under stress, which all of us, even if we're managing our COVID anxiety well, people with shaking will notice that shaking getting much worse. In saying that, you're absolutely right to, you know, to wonder what else could be happening to me. And that's what your neurologist that you currently see, as well as the next one that you'll be connected with, will be very good at helping you to figure out. So I would address that concern even with this neurologist who will be retiring. Tell them what your concerns are, and then that will help them be able to see what the next step is.
But Laura, I can understand you work with somebody for a long, long time, and it's you develop a nice relationship. So hopefully, exactly. As Dr. Bouillon-Dent said, you can talk those things over with him before, during your last conversation. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Rich in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Hey, hi, Larry. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I worked in physical therapy for 30 years, and I worked with literally thousands and thousands of Parkinson's patients. And unless it's a severe progressive disorder, most Parkinson's patients can lead a full life if they address the secondary problems. And the secondary problems would be obesity. It would be muscle tightness. It would be muscle weakness and coordination. And if they do a series of exercises, they can live just as long as you and I can. And I have these individualized inspirational speeches for every one of them. And normally they do very well under my care.
Well, Rich, thanks very much for calling. Dr. Laura, a comment?
Yes, physical therapy and exercise is one of the key things that we tell all of our patients with Parkinson's to participate in, and it makes a tremendous difference. He's absolutely right.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone else wondered, are soma form disorders considered a movement disorder?
Oh, I believe they're referring to somatoform disorders. And sometimes we will see movement disorders as part of a somatoform type of problem. The somatoform disorders have a wide range of symptoms that people can possess with them. And sometimes it will include abnormal movements as well. So, yes, we see a fair amount of people where we'll sometimes the term that we'll use is a functional movement disorder. An older term is psychogenic movement disorder, but that makes it sound like people are faking it, which we don't think they're faking it. We just don't have a good understanding of sometimes the mind-brain connection yet. So, but we're, you know, progress is being made in those areas. Those are very difficult disorders to live with as well as to treat.
Yeah, for sure. Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, our guest, a neurologist in the Movement Disorders Program at UW Health. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tim Peterson, our on-air producer. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. All here for you on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at movement disorders with our guest today, Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, neurologist in the Movement Disorders Program at UW Health. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions for her or comments, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take another call. Kay in Prairie du Sac, it's your turn now. Thank you for calling, Kay.
Well, thank you for the show. My question is, my mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's when she was 49 years old, and at the initial diagnosis, they did an extensive history, and one of the things the doctor asked was, had she had the Spanish flu? And she did have it as a toddler. And so my question is there a study looking at viruses in connection with these movement disorders?
Oh, interesting. Dr. Bouillon-Dent?
Yeah, interesting question. So for the Spanish flu, what they found afterwards is there was a certain group of people that developed some symptoms that were similar to Parkinson's disease, idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And there was this cohort of, or a group of people that had had the Spanish flu that had these particular symptoms. And so there has been a lot of research in the, you know, since that time regarding potential viral triggers and viral causes of the disease. So far, with all the viruses that we've all been exposed to, we haven't had a subsequent group of patients that have had a similar thing. We used to call it post-encephalitic Parkinson's disease. And we haven't seen that associated with any viruses since that time. But it's something that we monitor for, and even infectious disease specialists will monitor for as well. Of course, that brings up the current pandemic. And so far, we haven't seen a similar disease entity arising. However, it might be a little too soon yet to know some of those things.
Yeah,
I wouldn't panic about that. But that's with any type of virus. Sometimes it can affect the brain. But in the Spanish flu, that was at that point in time very specific to that virus.
Gotcha. Thank you very much, Kay, again for that call and question. Let's take another call. Emily in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Dr. Dent, my mom was a patient of yours many years ago. My sister and I would bring her in for appointments with you and your nurse, Nan. And I remember part of what was so frustrating was the fact that there isn't a clear-cut test to diagnose Parkinson's, which she was finally diagnosed with. But even up to the very end, we questioned at least the degree of which she had this. And it was further complicated with the fact that the Lewy body dementia began. And when that started, we were also told by her eye physician that she had something called Charles-Binet syndrome, which, for anyone who doesn't know, it's when a person sees what you and I might see as a vehicle across the street in someone's driveway. A person with Charles-Bonnet syndrome might see that vehicle, but then they might see a picnic going along with it. So it's kind of, it's that fine line of, is it the dementia? Is it the Charles-Bonnet? And just some of the frustration that comes along with all these complications that can show up with it. So if you care to comment on anything like that, and thank you so much for your care all those years.
Yes. Yes, these are, unfortunately, the Parkinsonian conditions are, you know, devastating, as you unfortunately know too well. And it's hard in this day and age if there's not a blood test or like a scan, that people are always looking for that sort of thing for a diagnosis. However, you know, the test for these conditions is actually being evaluated and doing this neurologic exam and being evaluated by an expert and a movement disorder specialist. And I think a lot of us hang our hats a lot on technology, unfortunately, and which makes it frustrating, because if I can't give somebody a blood test, for example, they don't trust that, oh gosh, this is really the diagnosis. And, you know, even brain scans have their limitations. Every test has their limitations, even blood tests do. And the frustration, of course, is feeling that if, you know, the diagnosis can't be state, that if we can make a diagnosis, I should say it this way, that if a definitive diagnosis is made, well, then there must be a treatment for it. And unfortunately, in many of these neurodegenerative disorders, even when we're very confident, you know, in saying, oh, yes, this is what we're dealing with, the there isn't a fix. And we just have, you know, we can only do our best treating the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And then over time as well, as we learn more, the terminology will change as well. So, for example, there's something called idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And then there's a different, what we consider now a different disease entity called dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body disease. And there can be some similarities, and it might be a spectrum disease. You know, so it's all a very confusing, ever-changing type of thing, which is highly frustrating for patients and families. And also especially, you know, they're watching the decline of their loved one, which is just very tragic, obviously.
Yeah.
So we are getting better at diagnosing and recognizing different things so that we can at least treat them symptomatically. And eventually there will be treatments that will halt progression of these diseases or even cure them. When that will occur, of course, we can't predict.
Yeah.
In fact, it's mean to predict because it puts people on a roller coaster.
No. Emily, thank you so much. You know, a related caller, a Glory from Upper Michigan, couldn't hang on, wondered if you could talk about multiple systems atrophy. Her husband received the diagnosis after initially being diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Right. So there's many disorders that are in this Parkinson's family, so to speak. And so one of them, and the most common one, is idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And that's what the majority of people have and has overall the best prognosis in comparison to some of the other forms. Another form is what I just mentioned, this dementia with Lewy bodies. And then multiple system atrophy is another one that's classified as one of the atypical Parkinsonian disorders to distinguish it or separate it from idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And again, this is made initially, people will show Parkinsonian signs of a variety in a variety of ways. And then over time, especially movement disorders specialists will relatively quickly recognize that, oh gosh, this isn't the garden variety Parkinson's, this is one of these related disorders. And that's where, when someone's a movement disorder specialist, they've been especially trained in screening for these things kind of continually. So whenever I see somebody I've diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, although I'm confident in the diagnosis, I'm keeping my eyes open to see what other signs and symptoms develop that might then lead me to thinking, oh gosh, maybe they have one of these other related disorders instead. Although early on, many of them all look very similar.
Even though they look similar, the treatments then are different.
Right. The prognosis and the progression can be a lot different.
I gotcha.
Okay. Yeah.
Dave in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed in 1995 with spinocerebellar ataxia down at Mayo Clinic. And my first symptom, I believe, was in about 1982. This ataxia takes on a lot of different levels. Some people don't last too long, and some do. And so it's been a long haul for me. I haven't walked without a walking aid for 20 years, but I still keep getting up in the morning and starting all over.
Dave, I think, yeah.
Yes. The spinocerebellar ataxias are something we're learning more and more about. There's over 40 different genetic forms of it, at least. We can't test for all of those, but they are. They're difficult. I can hear it in your voice, and your voice sounds clear, but hearing that you've had this for so long, you're doing really, really well. I'm very impressed that you're still able to walk using a walking aid and that you're not wheelchair-bound. That's wonderful. Although difficult, you must be taking very good care of yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have a wheelchair also for when we're out and about for going to doctor appointments or to restaurants, which, of course, we don't do at this point. But it helps. I still use a four-wheel walker here in the house to keep my joints lubricated. So
that's wonderful.
I've had a tremor for 30 years, but it hasn't kept me from getting too much food to my mouth. So
good for you. Okay. Good for you. Yes, Dave, living with these various abnormal movement disorders is really obviously tough on people. And in my practice, I'm so very fortunate to actually, you know, have these people share these things with me, and you get to meet some very remarkable people.
Well, it must be nice to have patients like Dave. Dave, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to join in. Marcus in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Marcus.
Thank you. Good morning. Dr. Dent, is it? Yeah, very informative. Thank you. I've done a little checking into this over the years myself, reading summaries in medical journals, whatnot. And there seems to be, as you mentioned, your caveat about not interpreting psychosomatic causes to these things. There does, however, seem to be some psychological components involved in movement disorders. And I'm wondering if you could tell me if there is any research that you're aware of that's multidisciplinary between neurologists and psychologists, and do things like meditation play a role, or as a corrective to some of these maybe more mild disorders?
Right. Yes. So there is the overall answer to your question is yes, there is a lot of research going on that's multidisciplinary, and sometimes the term integrative medicine will be used in these situations too. And we find you know, I find in my practice, whether someone has Parkinson's disease, that's causing a tremor, something called essential tremor or spinocerebellar ataxias, all of these things that can cause a tremor. Many people will use mindfulness techniques or even meditation to calm those tremors down in certain situations. And so there is a very, very much a mind-body connection, of course, and no matter what the cause of it is. And we do, you know, encourage people to use those techniques, of course, especially because they're non-invasive, right? And so we know that they're not harmful. But there is a, you know, a psychologic component, meaning that, you know, whenever somebody with movement disorders is under stress, they will notice that their symptoms are worse. And whether that stress is even a happy stress, you know, like a birthday party or something,
sure,
they'll notice their tremors are more so because they're revved up. And some of that is because their adrenaline is going. But there are a lot of techniques like that that we try to incorporate. You know, we have medicines, and of course, traditional physicians like myself, of course, we write lots of prescriptions, but we also have found that, you know, we don't want to over-medicate people, and that's one of the most harmful things that we can do. And so we're always, checking in with our patients, myself as well as my partners. We're all, you know, making sure that we, you know, have people on enough medicines, but that they're not over-medicated either. And that, you know, a medicine we prescribe is doing what we want it to and not just causing harm or doing nothing. We monitor all of those things very closely and also try to treat things the best we can without medications.
Marcus, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Anne in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Anne.
Thank you very much. I know that your specialty today in discussion is more for neurological problems. My husband has been diagnosed with IBM, inclusion body myositis.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I know that that's muscular, but I wonder if you could address that a little bit and maybe answer just a couple questions for me. He has been told by his neurologist that there is no medication and there is no cure. And I assume you would agree with that. And then could you tell me if there is any research that is going on regarding that?
So I'm familiar with IBM. I don't see patients with that currently, but every neurologist knows and has seen people during their training or whatnot with it. And you're right, there's still, you know, there's symptom treatment for it. And there is, I'm not familiar with all of the research in regards to that, but there is research going on about that, not specifically at UW, but that the inclusion body myositis is actually quite a rare disorder or disease. And but there is, you know, research going on looking at ways to slow down progression and as well as to better treat the symptoms. And probably I'm not sure if his current neurologist, but a neuromuscular specialist would be the expert in that area for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at knowing what the prognosis is and that sort of thing.
Anne, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Mary in Green Bay a chance to join in. Mary, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed several years ago with cervical dystonia, and have gone through many, many rounds of Botox injections using various strains of Botox, and none of them have been effective for more than a week to 10 days. Is there anything on the horizon for severe cervical dystonia beyond the Botox treatment?
Yes, there's always...
What is that, by the way?
Yes, good question. So cervical dystonia is an abnormal type of muscle spasm disorder, and this is affecting someone's neck. And so their head will be turned in unusual positions and can be quite painful. And it's not due to a problem with the actual muscles, but more the brain program that controls those muscles. And so we can't go in and mess around with the brain per se. So we try to treat this with using botulinum toxin injections, which is essentially like injecting a muscle relaxer into certain muscles. And it's it can be quite a disabling disorder, as this caller probably knows only too well. And some people will have a variable response to the injections. Other things that can be done in certain cases, there's surgical procedures that can be done in which certain nerves are cut, or even sometimes if it's super severe, muscles are cut. Sometimes we will even implant a neurostimulator into a certain part of the brain that can help alleviate some of the symptoms. None of the treatments, unfortunately, make somebody, you know, quote unquote, normal, you know, as if they wouldn't have this disorder, but it can help relieve some of the symptoms, depending. But you're not alone in having this variable response or kind of inadequate response to the different forms of Botox.
Thank you. Mary, does that help?
A little bit. It's very frustrating. Fortunately, it's not severely debilitating in my case, but it's very noticeable, you know, in terms of just anyone observing me can tell that my face is tilting to one side, and I kind of work around it, but it's, as you mentioned, does get more severe when my adrenaline tends to rise, whether that's in a happy situation or a negative situation, and it's just frustrating.
Well, Mary, I'm sorry for that, but I thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call very much. You know, these are folks who, the people we've talked with today are kind of heroes in my mind. They're putting up with a lot of pain, and they seem to be doing it with, you know, they're trying their best, and they're looking at all the options that they can, Dr. Dan.
Right, right. The people that have movement disorders like this truly are amazing with the means that they come up with to cope with these things, because our treatments are limited. So it's very inspiring in many ways, yes.
It is indeed. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I had other questions that I would like to have asked, so I guess we're going to have you back. Would you come back and be with us?
Of course, of course.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, a neurologist in the Movement Disorders Program at UW Health. Her focus is on the care of patients with movement disorders. She designs unique programs that suit their particular condition. So it was great to have her on, and we will certainly have her back to talk again. You know, there's a national study, I think it was in 2017, that reported that only 1 in 3 Americans have their advance directives completed. We'll be talking about that next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.